Hello and welcome to Conversations from the Adoption Fostering Podcast. In this episode, we speak to Gregory Luce from the Adoptee Rights Law Centre in the USA. Gregory, an adopted adult, offers personal and professional insight into the challenges faced by adoptees in the US, both in relation to law and wider culture. He also shares some of his personal experience of the challenges and difficulties of accessing his own records and the historical underpinning reasons for that. As always, if you have experience of adoption, fostering, or special guardianship from any perspective and would like to share that on the podcast, please get in touch through Facebook or Twitter, or you can email us at andfpodcast@gmail.com.
My name is Gregory Luce. I'm an attorney in Minnesota in the United States. I'm the attorney and founder of Adoptee Rights Law Center. And more recently, I've become the executive director of Adoptees United. I'm also adopted person. I was born and adopted in the District of Columbia when I was about 7 days old. And so I'm considered in the U.S. a domestic infant adoption during this period of time in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, where for predominantly white women and white middle-class families, it's considered the baby scoop era. I'm one of those.
So it's not uncommon that people who've got lived experience of adoption sort of find themselves in the working professionally in that sphere. So how do you become you're a lawyer. So tell me about what your practice is and how that sort of came about.
Yeah, I became a lawyer a long time ago, and I'm actually shocked to say I've been a lawyer for almost 30 some years. And but in the more recent, in the last 5 years, I've become what I call an adoptee rights lawyer. I think I'm the only one in the country that can call themselves that. And that means that I represent adopted people who are adults and have various issues that arise out of the U.S. Adoption system, which includes obtaining original birth records or other identity documents, or for inter-country adoptees who were adopted by U.S. citizen parents, figuring out their citizenship status and, if needed, securing citizenship or proving it. So that's been my work for the past 5 years. And it came about because of how hard it was for me to get my own records from the District of Columbia, which started in about 2015, so about 6 years ago. And the process in the District of Columbia, and it may be the same in many other states in the U.S., is you petition a court to unseal the records. And depending upon the standards that are used, they typically would need a good reason to unseal them. And they initially denied it, and then they approved it, but then redacted information from my files, including redacting information from my original birth certificate. And I already knew it. I was in reunion with my mother for many years before I tried to get my birth record, and I knew everyone involved. I mean, I knew both my mother and my father, and knew that they would be on the birth certificate, but my father's name was redacted because they didn't have his consent to list his name on the record. And I wasn't going to continue. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I mean, from a UK sort of perspective, that just is so shocking, really. But for me, I mean, does that cost you money as well? What sort of investment money do you need to stump up to go through that process?
Well, that's the beauty of being a lawyer. I mean, I didn't have to pay another lawyer. Course, I knew what I was doing. but that goes into why I started to do the work that I did, because after this 5 year, effort in which I had to appeal the trial court, and appeals court essentially agreed with me and sent it back. And I finally, after almost 5 years, received an unredacted birth record, listing everybody on it. No information was removed. But during that process, I looked around and said, it can't be this hard. It can't be this hard for other adopted people. And I found out, yeah, it is. It's extremely hard. And so I reviewed all the state laws and created resources so people could better understand what they may need to do or what they can't do as adult adopted people to get their original birth records. And so that became Adoptee Rights Law Center. And that's when I started to represent exclusively adult adopted people, and then it later added intercountry adoptees. Once I found out that there are thousands of intercountry adoptees in the U.S. who don't have U.S. citizenship, even though they are adopted by U.S. citizen parents. So it didn't cost, if I were to pay for what I did, I probably would have paid $40,000 to $50,000.
I mean, that's, yeah. I mean, that's serious money.
That's, oh yeah. Yeah.
And I mean, you already knew the information. So you, in some ways, what was the drive behind getting that those bits of paper?
The drive is really for me, and it's hard to explain, but when I held that piece of paper in the 2020 in the midst of the pandemic, and my wife was there, my son was there when I opened the envelope, and it was extremely meaningful, because I think the best way for me to explain it is that I have been denied this existence, this record of my existence for most of my life, and to have it verified and to have that piece of paper that verified as a government record that I was born in this place to these people at this time was very affirming for me. And I think it's very affirming for many adopted people to get their record of their origin, no matter what it says. I mean, sometimes it's not correct information or accurate, but it is the record that existed at the time. It's a contemporaneous recording of who you were. And that's often the information that's left out of our lives. And so that was the drive. And I happened along the way to get adoption agency records, which are the hardest records to get in the U.S. They have the most valuable information. And from that information, I learned quite a bit about my relinquishment and adoption.
So they like the contemporaneous sort of case notes of who said what happened on what day, exactly. Those sort of things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the comment by the social worker that my dad sounded like a truck driver, and my adoptive dad. Yeah, but he was a psychologist. But just funny comments that you find within there that, you know, the focus, what was interesting too, was the real focus on the coloring, my coloring, and that thankfully I matched the coloring of my brother, who has it, was also adopted by different parents. But the social workers found that extremely positive that I would match the coloring of at least one of the family members. And that was a big focus back in the 50s and 60s. This is before transracial adoption. Yeah.
But for the most part.
I mean, I think transracial adoption was started in 48, I think, but it wasn't prominent.
I mean, that again, that's a hugely politicized kind of occurrence, but I'm really curious about this idea of you gaining access, but mainly because you were a lawyer anyway, you've got the resources. It, as you say, it didn't cost you anything other than time. So then I can see a clear injustice for, is that the situation for all adoptees in the US then, that regardless of the states, that they do not have access or like a right to their birth records?
It's the reality for majority of adopted people. Or I would say majority of the states. It all depends upon where you're born. And then in some respects, it relates to where you were adopted. Sometimes you were born in, let's say, Virginia, but then adopted in Maryland. So those are a little more complicated. But over the course of the last, you know, when they started to seal these records so that no one could have them, was in 1935. And by about the mid-80s, every state had some sort of restriction, whether it's, you know, required intermediaries or consent of a birth parent or a redaction of information. Every state had done that except for two, and that was Alaska and Kansas. And so as adoptees became older and had the same desire to know who they were that I had in the year 2000, you started to see advocacy crop up. Yeah. And that started essentially for adopted people, that started, it could be as early as the 40s and 50s with Gene Payton, but it really started to get fuel in the mid 70s. And it's sort of developed over the years into a movement. I call it a movement. And I mean, I worry about actually getting the historic documents of our early parts of this movement to unrestrict our records. So today we stand at 10 states that have the ability for an adult adopted person to request their record, and they'll pay a small fee, and within, you know, a few weeks they'll get their original birth record. But then there's, you know, 20 some odd states that have various restrictions You know, could be redaction, could be consent based. And then there are other about 18 states that you can't get it at all without a court order. You have to petition the court, just like I did.
And I'm sure you've given this a lot of thought, but what is the primary motivation between restricting access?
It's changed over time. I mean, we were tied up being an adopted person, you know, in 30s, 40s, 50s, even to today, was tied up in what we all think of illegitimate births or out of wedlock births. And the hiding of that status was critical in the essentially in the 20s and then growing from there. And adoption was seen as a way to legitimate a child if they were born out of wedlock, which for the most part, the vast majority were like myself as well, were not born to married parents. So it grew out of hiding that status and figuring out a way to legitimate a child. It also grew out of efforts to prevent what was in the 1930s blackmail of adoptive parents, in which if the birth record was public, which it was in many places, anyone could obtain the birth record, the original birth record, and then go to the adoptive parent and say, hey, we're going to tell your kid that he or she was adopted. And that was the first state was California to seal records because of that issue. That was a cited issue. But as it grew over time, there are a couple of things that happened. One was, it initially was the reason to seal these records was to sever the relationship between the adoptee and the birth parent, and also keep the birth parent from interfering with the adoptive parent relationship. And that was the main reason. It wasn't about making a birth parent anonymous, or it wasn't about birth parent privacy. It was originally about strengthening the adaptive family, because they were, you know, birth parents were considered potential interferers, even though they really weren't. But that's what it was about. And then on top of that, what we've seen growing from the 50s, 60s, and 70s I consider it sort of a marketing strategy on the part of adoption agencies to say, we have very confidential services. No one will know. And this is a way to facilitate more adoptions, especially infant adoptions for women who felt that they had no other choice. And so I think that's been laid upon this initial structure that existed in the U.S. And that becomes the main opposition today. Is the question, well, what about the birth parent's privacy? And we hear that in every state we try to get access to our records. Yeah.
That feels like spin, doesn't it? That may have been true in 1930s, wherever, but it feels like spin now, doesn't it? It's twisting of the narrative.
It is. And that's what happened. It's twisted the narrative to fit, the industry of trying to increase adoptions or supply infants to adoptive parents. And that's really what it's all about.
So you've got, you've got 10 states that have kind of have repealed that. Is it repeal the seal? Is that the movement?
The one in Ireland. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know where I got that hashtag from.
I actually had to ask someone the other day, what's repeal the seal again? Who is that? I mean, oh yeah, Ireland. We call it restoring the right because we once all had it. So it's restoring the right to request and obtain your birth record. Yeah.
So that's the
only thing that we're after. We're after the birth record. There are other records. There are the court records. There are the agency records. There may be maternity home records. There may be hospital records, but we're focused on, as a movement, on the issue of the original birth record, which has our genetic information on it.
So are you seeing any movement in the other, forgive my maths, 41 states? 40 states?
There's always legislation that's pending. We probably have, four or five states pending with legislation currently. It all depends, that issue all depends upon keeping adoptees united around the issue. And we're not united, unfortunately. There are small groups of adopted people who believe it's acceptable for birth parents to redact information, or for a consent-based system where the birth parents must consent to release your own birth record. So when you have, when you don't have unity in that, in a very basic right that we believe in so strongly, it really undermines the ability to establish that right in, you know, 50, 51 jurisdictions. And so that's part of the battle is, you know, some advocates have essentially given up and said, well, we'll just take this. And that's been unfortunate. And mm-hmm. it sometimes leads to, you know, what I consider toxicity in our movement as well.
That's really complicated.
It is.
It feels that, yeah, that it feels like that the industry, your words, it can, I don't know why I said your words, the industry, it's an industry. Right. It really is.
I know. No matter how you look at it, it has to be an industry.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, you could spin it good, you could spin it bad, but it is. It is what it is.
And people are making money off of it. And then, But they've always, if there's people who will sort of side by them who are adopted, then they've got a trump card, haven't they? Basically, they can.
That's the problem. That's the real problem. They have the trump card. They can. I mean, I don't mean to use Trump as the
bad use of words.
But no, that's the issue. You lose any footing to say that this is a right and it should be restored when essentially the entire industry is then against what you're trying to do. No, I should say there are a lot of adoptive parent allies. There are a lot of birth parent allies. There are a lot of industry allies who see this as an issue that does need to get resolved and restored. It's my position. I can't compromise on an absolute right to request and obtain your birth record. It's yours. It's our record. Yeah. And every time we bring it up, we get the whataboutisms and the horror stories that people talk about, people showing up at the birth parent's door and saying surprise, which never happens. I mean, it may happen once or twice every once in a while. But, and the other thing is no one worries about the other way around where a birth parent shows up at the door of an adopted person, and which you could certainly do through DNA, but no one worries about. I mean, if we're talking about privacy, which I reject, if we're talking about privacy, it doesn't exist the other way. And there's no concern over the privacy of the adopted person, typically. So I think it's just a false pretense.
Yeah. And it feels like that. I think that's, we were chatting beforehand about the difference between the UK and the US. And I think that for-profit element is kind of, it does feel that it brings a different flavor to everything, that there's always people who are trying to make money.
Right.
And that influences everything because they're wanting to protect their market, aren't they?
Right. And, you know, I think it would be a really good exercise for the US to examine what would adoption look like in the US, whether it's intercountry adoption or domestic, if you took all the money out of it. Like, what would it look like? And I can't answer that question. I don't know what it would look like, but I think it would be better. I assume it would be better. But you know, I've had other advocates propose, this is what we got to do. We got to take the money out of adoption. And, you know, and we discussed this before we got on, but you know, the US is so complicated because adoption is essentially decentralized in the US. We don't have a federal system of adoption that controls the rules and regulations in all the states. I mean, the federal government typically gets involved in trying to set priorities using their federal money as the tool to get states to respond. But individual states are the ones that control who and how adoption occurs and what control is exerted over the records. And so you have these, if you're trying to establish a right, you really can't at this point without some sort of court ruling, establish a federal right to your own birth record. You have to go state by state by state. And that's really the part of the issue as well, is that it's decentralized.
Which is, I mean, in the UK, I think we've only, maybe in the last year or so, we've started to see groups of adopted people coming together to try and speak with one voice. And they've always sort of sat under the banner of adoption charities. But the complexity of then trying to impact across the whole state, like the 50 states and the District of Columbia, trying to get unification within states, and, you know, obviously then state by state basis, it just feels like it's a huge task. And it must be exhausting for people like yourself, but also, you know, if you're just an adopted person trying to get the records, it must be just so disheartening.
It is. It's both. It's both exhausting for those who are involved in the work, and it's disheartening for those who, like me, believe it should be easy to request and obtain your record. And that's why a number of us started Adoptees United, which is, in the U.S., it's a national nonprofit. It's a charitable organization that educates on these issues. But we also help with understanding the issue, messaging on the issue, and even providing infrastructure and logistics for state groups to form and advocate effectively in their states. So it is an effort to, and you know, that's the name, Adoptees United. It's an effort to unite around very core issues that relate to domestic adoptees as well as intercountry adoptees. So that's the thought. It's the only national adoptee rights organization other than Bastard Nation that I'm aware of. Hmm.
You mentioned intercountry adoptees, and an issue that I was talking to someone who I know in the US, and they were sort of sharing with me, and I'll keep it confidential, because they were saying, you know, I've lived in the US all of my life, bar like literally a number of days, but I'm not a US citizen. And we were talking about it, and on the news there was the whole issue around the Dreamers, the, you know, that this, mm-hmm. and she was saying, I'm frightened, not frightened, maybe too strong a word, but you know, there could be a knock at the door. There could be a knock, you know, some burly men could remove me.
Right. And I think that's, it's a legitimate fear depending upon your immigration status as an intercountry adoptee. It was definitely a very present fear when the Trump administration was in power, because there was a huge focus on getting what he believed was getting rid of people who don't belong here. Mm. And if you're not a citizen and it's possible you don't have a green card or a legal permanent resident card, you're not considered welcome here, even though you were adopted by US citizen parents. It's the whole intercountry adoption issue with citizenship is such a heartbreaking and just completely wrongheaded approach to adoption itself. When you can adopt a child from another country, bring them here, and then their citizenship is not secure. And I do represent intercountry adoptees, and I get calls every week about a new client who found out when they applied for a passport that they aren't in fact a U.S. citizen. And there's the numbers are anywhere from 20,000 to 50,000intercountry adoptees that are not citizens. Now there is a fix. It's Adoptee Citizenship Act of 2021 that seems to be stalled in Congress. But if it were to pass today, it would give citizenship to the vast majority of those adopted people. So there's a fix, but it's just not, there's no real momentum in Congress to move anything like that.
Yeah, the bigger fish to fry, as they say.
Yeah, and it's odd, because is this, for many intercountry adoptees, is this an issue that should be wrapped up in immigration reform? Or some adoptees say, no, this is a foreign policy issue and a family matter. And for the most part, it's seen as an immigration issue. And so you're kind of lumped into the immigration reform, which is such a hot button topic in the U.S. that no one wants to touch it, or no conservative wants to touch it. Yeah. Although the Adoptee Citizenship Act is a completely bipartisan effort. I mean, you've got crazy conservatives on one side and what people consider crazy liberals on the other, but you just can't get it done. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's the nature of lawmaking, isn't it? It sometimes the issues get lost in the mire of politics, don't they?
Living here in the U.S. right now is not very pleasant. It really is not. It's just, you're not sure where you're going to go in the next year and what's going to happen. And you're a little fearful of, I mean, I'm talking politics now, but you're fearful of the future for yourself and for other people that you love or work with. And I think that's really hanging over a lot of people here.
I mean, I don't think you can remove adoption from politics, or can you? Because I think that it's, even within the last, few months, I've seen the whole the issue of abortion. And I think, was it Amy Comey Barrett who'd sort of, whether it was glibly or very purposefully, used adoption as a, as a part of a gambling, or it was thrown into a comment about the Abortion Act, or the whole case. And it just sort of, it was just inflammatory and just raised, again, huge issues around how people perceive adoption in the US, which I think is a, watching on is really odd.
Yeah, it was definitely deliberate. I mean, the idea of, and she used what's called safe haven laws as the example, which is even worse, because safe haven laws is essentially legal infant abandonment. Without any questions asked, you just take a child to a hospital or a fire station or a police station, and you relinquish that child with no questions asked, and there's no recording of who the parent is. But that was the specific laws that she was referencing, which obviously sent out alarm bells for all adopted people, because suddenly it bypasses all the regulations that surround adoption itself. And, you know, ultimately those kids who are relinquishing, there's very, very few in the US, are typically adopted because they're infants and they're in demand. But there's no back history for that adoptee because of the way safe haven laws exist. And so that it was a very deliberate framing of the issue by Justice Coney Barrett. And it was it's something that's been argued by conservative policymakers who are anti-adoption to use safe haven laws as an example of what's called a solution. But it's a solution to abortion, and adoptees should never be considered a solution to abortion. It's just not. But as you know, you're watching in the UK, it's so central to every debate here about abortion that it's really hard to keep abortion politics out of our own issues. And what I try to tell legislators is that, you know, if you want to debate abortion, go over to a different committee, because that's what they're considering. We're talking about our birth records here, not whether we're some sort of solution to abortion.
Beyond that, is adoption sort of universally seen as a good thing within sort of a US context?
I think the answer to that is going to be whether it would relate to your politics, essentially. I think that if you're to look at the sort of the rugged individualism nature of how the US tries to represent itself in a narrative, I think using that and projecting that out, yes, then politically adoption is seen as a good thing. They see it as a solution, and they see it in the terms of, you know, all this sort of positive adoption language that is used, like the forever family or number of, you know, different narratives that I can't stand, because it doesn't, it glosses over the reality of adoption. I think that's the hard part. You're fighting against this narrative that really is hovering over you all the time when you're trying to raise issues that aren't right about adoption.
Yeah. And is there a differentiation between the sort of the private system and the foster care system, where you do have a lot of children who are adopted, and right up to, you know, children into their teens and mid-teens can be adopted from the foster care system? But obviously, are the two seen as very separate, or are they just seen part of the whole sort of whole adoption world?
I think they're seen very separate. I mean, I think the narrative of adoption imagines infant adoption. It does not typically include adoptions out of care, or we call it foster care. And, you know, a vast amount of resources are spent on increasing adoptions out of foster care. But it hasn't really changed much in the last decade or so. Mm-hmm. And the demand for infant adoptions is always there and will remain, I think. Because that's the demand, if it's a market product, an infant being adopted, that's the highest market price. If you want to, you know, look at it as a market driven industry, which it is.
Yeah, it is. And I think, you know, in the UK, occasionally we see information around, you know, that different children cost different amount of money, which seems is quite stark, the brutality mm-hmm. of that kind of that capitalist system.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's been there for many, many years, and you could actually return a child if it didn't, for many years, you could return a child that didn't work out for you, and or you could get a discount if you were going to adopt a child who had Puerto Rican descent. And, you know, these are all well-documented pricings that you could read in adoption documents that you can get if you're lucky to get them.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the infant adoption program at the Gladney Center for Adoption, which is one of the major adoption agencies in the U.S., they have what's called a flat fee system, and I believe it's in the mid $50,000s to adopt $50,000 to adopt an infant.
That's a lot of money.
It's a crazy amount. Yeah, and that gets back to the whole issue of like, what would it look like if we took the money out? What would adoption look like if that was the case? And some people say that's what adopting out of foster care is about, because there are all sorts of subsidies, and there may not be. There's certainly not the costs you have with infant adoptions or any other alternatives to adoption. But we may be left with what you have, what the UK has, and that is you adopt out of care.
Yeah, I mean, we still have a financial arrangement if it's between different local authorities, but it's not a profit arrangement. It's just we've paid to assess this. So there's it's not insignificant, but it doesn't come out of any, it comes out of the public purse, not out. And it's between, you know, different organizations. So there's no for profit arrangements in that. There are a few profit orientated organizations, but very few that capitalize that, but nothing.
Are there lawyer fees, or do you do a barrister or solicitor that you have to pay?
No, none of that. It's all done through the local authority.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's handled by maybe a public official. When I assume you go to court to get the decree approved. And
yeah. I mean, basically it literally costs you nothing. You may pay for a birth certificate, which would be like £50, whatever, $100.
Right.
But literally, it costs you nothing to be approved and have a children placed with you. I'm not saying that our systems, please don't, I'm not kind of coming over here and kind of going, well, our system's much better, because it's not. I think there's all kinds of problems. And so thinking about, I think what you've said has been amazingly insightful in getting an idea of how the US system works. And I think that you have the US has an influence over the adoption culture and the adoption narrative. And we see some of that stuff sort of, you know, the things like the gotcha day, that kind of, those memes, those things, we see them sort of creeping into the UK, so can you share a little bit about your thoughts on the kind of the US culture on adoption, how it, you know, how pervasive it is or isn't, or, you know, maybe leading you. It's a leading question, isn't it? That one. I apologize.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. It's a great question, because it's so tough to answer given the history of adoption in the U.S. and what adoption culture means to different people. I mean, I can talk as a white domestic infant adoptee, and my experience is going to be completely different from, let's say, a indigenous person who was forcibly removed from their home and as part of a 1960s, 70s, I think it even went into the 80s, Indian adoption project. And that culture of using adoption to, whether it's eugenics or whether it's ideological, to control a population of real humans in by using adoption. And so that culture is going to be vastly different than the culture I experience. But if I were to say that there's sort of a broad culture, it would be one that's really hard to criticize because of what we often hear in return. So for instance, if I were to criticize adoption, and I do, and people would assume that I hate adoption. And they may ask me, well, what does your adoptive mother think about your work? And which are all irrelevant questions, or they might be interesting questions to answer if you, you know, instead of talking with a friend, but they're all irrelevant. But it's sort of thrown back that you are to be defined by as an adoptee, but we're actually going to define what adoptee means. And so it's obtaining that autonomy to speak on our own without having these whataboutisms or the narrative of adoption hoisted back onto us. And I don't think we've reached a national voice on that issue yet. I think we're getting there. And I think that we will get there, but it's going to take some more time. But yeah, again, the cultural, even in transracial adoption is another, you know, entirely different cultural experience and cultural narrative that involves ideology and you know, who is considered an adoptable child. Same with intercountry adoption as well, especially to the U.S. So, you know, I feel honored that I have a lot of advocate friends who are come from all those communities, so they inform me on their issues as well.
Hmm. Are you optimistic?
I think for me, it's hard to be optimistic right now in the where the U.S. is going politically. And I say that because, you know, I have the outdated thought that facts matter and that research matters and but I'm very worried that ideology is controlling everything or will soon control everything if it didn't already, but more so than it has in the past, and that what you believe is essentially more powerful than what is actual. And so I think that filters down into adoption. I think we're seeing with, especially with the comment of Justice Coney Barrett, that there's some ideology here that is being pursued, and we may not have sufficient control over it because the narrative of adoption is so hard to change. So yeah, I wouldn't do the work I do without being optimistic in some way, but I'm fearful of the future. But at the same time, I'm really encouraged by seeing so many adopted voices, and young voices too, come up. I mean, the young adoptees, a lot of transracial adoptees on TikTok, is really interesting to hear what their issues are and how they approach their experience as adoptees. So I am buoyed by that, but at the same time, fearful. Yeah. I mean, generally, I think a lot of people are fearful of what we're going to get in the next 4 years here. I think we feel like we're on a turning point and it could go either way.
I'm clearly not from the US, but I can see that there's shadows of it coming into our culture, where it's things get pulled into the culture war, where it's you what you think about the issue is not relevant. It's which side you're on is relevant. It's where you sit and who you want to be aligned with. And so the issue is becoming unimportant. It's like, I am left, I am right, I am pro, I am against. And you get pulled into that, and it, like you say, facts and truth and what's right and wrong aren't that important anymore.
And that filters into adoptee rights advocacy as well. It's whose side are you on? Are you what's called a unrestricted, not compromising, or are you a compromiser? And then it can be very toxic. And I'm seeing that more and more within the community. It's you're disunited because you can't agree on a specific approach or right. Mm-hmm. And that concerns me too. I think on the issue of birth records, I think we'll win that narrative as advocates. It's going to be pretty bumpy over the next several years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts? I mean, this is maybe a silly question, but often I don't want to presume anything about what you actually think about adoption ultimately. Is that, do you think adoption has a future? Like, if you could clear away all the politics and we were looking for solutions for children, what do you think? Do you think adoption has its place in it, or should it be amended to be something else?
That's a really hard question for me because I give a lot of thought to it. And I mean, it sounds like I'm sort of punting on this, but I don't have a strong opinion on that. Other than I think I'm listening a lot to the people who don't think adoption is a viable option, or, you know, has a real future, and trying to incorporate their thoughts into how I think. I think that it'll be around for a long time. I do think that. And I think that needs to be reformed. One thought that I'm, you know, initially maybe 3 years ago, I would have thought was crazy, was this idea of, instead of having an adoption, which severs any biological relationship, it's more along the lines of a legal guardianship. And I thought, well, that doesn't make sense to me because there's no real permanency. There's no real sense of being, you know, part of that family permanently.
Yeah.
But I think that could be a possibility at this point. I think that that is a potential solution. And I'd say that in this way too, though, that for me, the issue of being an adopted person is reclaiming autonomy that you never had in the first place. I mean, you were an infant or you're young and you didn't have the autonomy to make the decisions that have impacted your life for the rest of your life. But is there a way in which we can reclaim that autonomy as adults? And it could be that if you had a legal guardianship until you could make the decision to be adopted as an adult, and that guardianship would then essentially turn into adoption, maybe that's a future. Or if an adoption did not work for you at all, and you maybe it was an abusive relationship or an abusive adoption, you could undo that and reclaim your autonomy and be rid of that adoption. Not in a hard, difficult way of what you would have to do currently, which is, you know, go to court and have a long, drawn out process, but something that's simple. And so I think of it now in terms of what do we want as autonomous? What do we want to reclaim our autonomy, and thinking of it in that way? As opposed to a broader question, is adoption have a future, or is adoption a good thing or a bad thing? I think it's obviously it's complicated. And I also listen to the people who say adoption is, they call it I can't remember now. You have to clip this part out.
Oh, please, no editing.
No, but who think in that way? It's complicated, and there is no easy solution, mm-hmm. or categorical solution to adoption. But yeah. There's plenty of ways to reform it. Yeah,
I've that's really made me think about that. This idea of, you know, almost like at 20, the age of 20, someone sits you down and says, "Well, what do you want to make of this? You know, how do
exactly.
you want to progress? Do you want to keep it as it is? Do you want to open the doors? Do you want to forget the whole damn thing?"
And I would guess that the vast majority of adopted people would say, "I'm good with it. Let's turn it into something else. Like, let's turn it permanent." And that there would be those who wish to end it.
Yeah.
And maybe even mutual. And so that needs to be something that could be done. Yeah.
Well, it's really interesting because my daughter's, she's 16 and we've had a few conversations, and she's adopted. One of the things we talked about is her wanting to kind of reclaim a name, which actually I'm totally fine with. She was questioning about, this is her surname, not her first name. And actually I said, "That's totally your choice, actually." And it made me feel a bit funny, and I kind of had to go away and think about why I felt funny. What was that all about? Which is just me being a stupid dad, I think.
I think you should acknowledge that. I think it's right for you to acknowledge that publicly, that you felt funny and it was kind of weird. And I don't know if I want to do that, because that's legit. I mean, I can imagine my adoptive mother would feel the same way. It's like,
yeah,
this idea of being, you know, rejected.
And I said to her, but ultimately it's your choice, you know. I didn't want to be one of these heavy-handed parents who kind of like lays emotions on my child. And she kind of went, "Oh, well, it's something I'm thinking about." I went, "Totally fine." And you think that actually maybe I'm a progressive. Maybe I'm, you know, I inhabit this world, so I might be ahead of the curve in some, well, hopefully, in some issues. But that she needs to have that choice. That's what she needs, yeah. The choice to do what she wants to do with this arrangement that we enforced on the baby.
Right. And my guess is that it's not going to change the relationship. The relationship is there. Yeah. And it sounds strong. And it's what she wants to identify with or how she wishes to identify. And why not?
Yeah. So this interview with you turned into a therapy for me.
You'll have to deal with the narrative of adoption, you know, on top of that, where you'll get all sorts of different, and she will too, all sorts of questions like, well, wait, what's your name? What's your last? Wait, who's that?
Yeah.
But that's just, you know, as we grow as humans, those complications sort of fall aside.
Yeah. Well, Craig, I'm aware we've talked for coming up for an hour and taking up loads of your time. So I have found this a really fascinating conversation, and your kind of insight into the world you inhabit is just amazing and really, really helpful. So I don't know if there's any questions you were hoping to answer that I haven't asked. I don't know whether that's a...
No, it's been a really, really good conversation. I love doing these because I get to talk, you know, I feel free to talk about these issues. I don't feel challenged by where you're coming from. I appreciate talking to an adoptive parent. I have no qualms about that. You're part of this whole process. And so it's been enjoyable to talk about these things.
So, Greg, thank you so much for sharing with me and sort of being so open and honest and stuff. And the depth of knowledge is just fantastic. So wish you well with all of your campaigns. And I shall put all of the ways of getting in touch with the work that you do in the show notes. So thank you very much.
Thanks. I really appreciate talking to you. It's been great.